My name's Burnt Brady, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi,
everybody. I need to tell you just, I need to share things with you. I want you to feel that I'm part of you, you know, and you're part of me. So I wore this suit for the first time since last summer, and I've gained 10 pounds. And I've got my top button undone and half my fly unzipped so that I can breathe. And I feel close to you somehow, and I wanted to share that with you. And I can tell you I'm a lot closer to you than I was before I unzipped this blind. I have not been known to projectile vomit sober, but I was afraid I was going to tonight if I didn't unzip my fly. So needed to start off that way for some reason. Anybody, those of you here from the treatment center saying, what the hell is he doing that for, you know? And even those of you've been here for a while say, what the hell is he doing that for? But I just want to be a part of you so bad, you know? And be accepted and loved. I've noticed the problem with this conference is you people are just too damn tense. You know, I mean, I knew last night that it was going to be something special when Jim forgot to have the countdown, count it, whatever y'all have, and interrupted right after the serenity prayer, so we started over, and the young lady who was up here decided we wouldn't read how it works. I was just wonderful. I love the whole way. I mean, it was, and then Scott finished talking, and nobody had his gift. Now, they really believe nobody is in charge of this place, I can tell you. And I said, so Saturday night I'll come. Somebody's got to take this group over and lead them out of this mess. But that is a tribute to John. John is able to lead by example and not have to pull these reins in. And I appreciate very much your calling in, asking me to talk. It's been a very special time being here. I've been deeply affected, starting from just getting here and Gay picking us up at the airport and driving. We did drive over in incredibly bad weather, and it was just neat. You know, I tell you what's neat about it is I kept thinking, these people really want to have a conference. You know, I mean, because I grew up in a place in western Kentucky, which is much like Greenville. Damn it, you got to want to go there bad to get there, you know. I'm serious. I mean, in Mayfield, y'all do have planes that fly in here. We didn't have planes that flew in there, so we had to drive. And so I found out to get to Greenville to come to a conference, you really got to want to do that. And the Spirit really tells me that. You know, I immediately saw what y'all have here and thought this was wonderful. And I thought, what they need, this is me. You understand? And those of you who know me understand why I would say this. They got to get a bigger place so they can get more people in so they can do this even bigger, you know? It ain't broken. I'm going to fix it anyway. Hell, why not? That's what I do best, is cause confusion. I mean, I'm sure none of y'all can relate to that. People you've been around y'all their life can sure as hell relate to it, but y'all can't relate to that, you know? But it was wonderful driving over and talking with her. We stopped at a little filling station, and Gay went in with us, and I was sitting there looking at her, and we'd been talking, and I thought, she doesn't look right. And, I'm talking about, y'all may think she doesn't look right all the time, but I mean, she didn't particularly look right at that particular time. She looked different. And I said, are you tired? And she said, well, no, I'm not tired. And I said, I hugged her. I said, hug me. So we hugged, and I said, what's the matter? And you know, it's kind of like, she'd been away from the baby. You know, and that was really neat. I mean, I don't know if I've ever seen anything any more beautiful when it dawned on me that this was a mother who was being away from a baby for 4 hours, 5-month-old baby. And this was really magnificent to me. And it really told me that, you know, she'd driven over there to get Casey and me and was going to be gone from her baby for 4 hours. And that was a significant move on her part, a significant move of love, you know. And I thought, we're going to have a hell of a time. This is the way it's going to be. And we got here, and then today Kenny took us out to the place and gave us the honor and dignity of showing us his home and looking around. Looking at John, looking at Kenny's baby pictures, and looking at John, my God in heaven, you know, I mean, it looked like they stamped one out 50 years later. And there it was, you know. Haven't had one look like that. Okay, God, here's just got another one. But it was just magnificent to be a part of this community. I'm safe here. I feel safe here. And I've talked a lot of places and been a lot of places in my life where I may have done a decent job and I really didn't know I was there doing God's will as best I could figure it, but I never particularly felt like I was belonged there, and it wasn't just all me, or didn't really feel all that safe there, but I feel safe here. Which means God knows I may sing for an answer, or hell, I don't know. I really never know, and I'm sure God says, you think that's my will, you read the wrong book, jackass, and we'll start over, but, I do feel safe here. The speakers, I'm far enough along in recovery that I have enough sense to be afraid of somebody drunk with a gun. But I don't get afraid of much anymore except things that I should be afraid of. So I'm not afraid to speak in this parade of speakers. I feel real honored to be in this parade of speakers. But I will tell you one thing. I don't know that I've ever been more singularly affected by a group of speakers than I have by the speakers that have been here this weekend. And I have no reason to believe that Sunday morning will be any different because I've heard Karen, one of her last talks, and Alabama, and to be magnificent. When I listened to Scott last night, I've never really heard my story in AA, and I didn't hear it last night. But I've very rarely even listened to a speaker that I thought reminded me of me. I just never have. But God, when I listened to him last night, I thought, I knew at times what he was going to say before he opened his mouth, and I'd never heard him before. Because my mind is just like his. About the only thing I'm really afraid of in my whole life is me and my mind. Because I tell you, that sucker can make me believe that blue is green flying upside down on a frog. You know, that's just the way I am. I mean, that's just the way I am. And I watched his mind, and I thought, my God in heaven, it was incredible. And I was with him every minute. And Jim, in all honesty, I was at Jim's place in Alabama not too long ago talking at a conference that he chairs. And I've loved Jim Miller for a long time. I've respected him for a long time. We had been apart for quite a while, and it may be some of the dynamic that's changing in their lives right now, and I'm sure it is, but I also love Christy. And I'm sure that plays a part in it. Jim affected me deeply today talking about the changes in their lives and the depth of the spirituality and the trust and the love that's going on with him and Christy and the whole family, the whole thing. And I told him that. I don't think I could adequately tell you, except just to say how much you mean to me and how much that taught me to me. I'm very fond of the morning speaker. Only because she has saved my ass so many times that I just can't begin to tell you how many times, you know. Obviously, for those of you who don't know, the morning speaker is my wife. She gave an incredible AA talk. I don't know that I've ever met a human being in my life that I've gotten to know very intimately that I respect and love any more than I do my wife. She is truly the most honest, most sincere, and the most spiritual human being I've ever known. And that's the truth. Here lately, honest to God, I've been telling her that in private, too. I don't know how much of the story will come out, but for me to be saying that, is I never quit loving her, but I sure did do a number on our marriage. Not because I'm a bad person, but I gotta tell you, if there was ever an alcoholic that starts with a capital A and ends with a capital C, you're looking at him. And if you think I'm unique, then look in the mirror. So let's go. Okay? This talk is for the newcomer. It's also for me. It's for that individual who has been sober 1 year and has finally decided they burned their brain up and they're just absolutely terrified because they still can't find their car in the parking lot. It's for the person with 2 years who thinks he's just absolutely got it all together right now. He has found the answer and he's really ready to go. And the one with 5 years who has decided that if he doesn't shoot himself or if they don't hide all the guns, he's going to. And the one with 10 years who really does have it wired, who doesn't really need to tell anybody about it anymore. He just knows he's got it, you know? And the one with 20 years who decides that you know, that he really doesn't need to go to regular AA meetings. They'll have these private meetings on the side. And the one with 30 years, he doesn't have to have a sponsor because they don't need a sponsor. And the one with 42 years, whose wife died, who was lonely and decided his new girlfriend who drank wine with dinner, he should drink wine with her too because he didn't want to lose her because he was so lonely. That's what this talk's about, because I made 12 step calls on every one of those people. And I won't talk about that. I decided some time ago that it was more important for me to tell the things that I have experienced and the things that I have learned in AA, because I just finally got tired of burying people. You know, and I know I'm not in charge of who lives or dies, but I'm damn sure in charge of carrying every message, every minute of every message I've got, because somebody out there may actually be listening. And I want to be real sure that when they make that decision that I've given them everything I've got, that decision of whether they want to live or die. And that's exactly what every alcoholic has to decide. You want to live or you want to die. Because this disease is 100% fatal. I don't mean to preach or teach when I give this talk, but I do both. And the fact is, I don't apologize for either, because if there hadn't been preachers and teachers in my life, I'd be dead. So sometimes when I get to preaching and teaching, those of you who want to take a nap, go ahead. Those of you who are inspired, you know, cry and share and clap and do the things you want to do. And those of you who are just waiting and tolerating me until I get through with it, just go ahead and do that too. But I'll do quite a bit of that. The miracle of recovery. You know, this room is full of miracles. And any alcoholic who's in this room who's breathing and not drunk is a miracle. Because every one of us should be dead. Yeah? And the fact is, if we don't stay sober and do the things we need to do to stay sober, each one of us will be dead. And I've become fascinated by looking at this miracle of recovery. And some of the insights that I've gained in this miracle of recovery, and I used to make it real complicated, and today I don't find it to be really that complicated anymore, at least not today. A fascinating thing about observing people and watching this miracle of recovery. Miracle of recovery for me has come, and I'll give you the examples I've seen. There's a beautiful couple from Bessemer, Alabama. She's the alcoholic, he's the Al-Anon. I guess they've been around 15 years. Is that about right, Bo? Heard about 15 years? And they had a son, a beautiful son. In his early 20s. He wasn't an alcoholic. He got killed in a car wreck. This was approximately, I'm going to say, 8 years ago. And I watched Shirley go into this rigid, fishwife, hate God. Why did it happen to me? Is there any God? The whole deal. And she continued to talk from the podium. And I watched her start this journey of hate. And victimization, and why me, God, and is there a God, and if there is, you got no guts. Same thing we've all felt, right? But she continued to talk, and I was privileged to see her at intervals so that I could see this change occurring. And I saw this evolution begin to take place that only can be described as a miracle, because, I mean, this was a tragic death for which there seemed to be no logical reason or answer or rhyme or reason. And I began to see her mellow. I began to see her move in that direction, away from the hatred and the venom and the victimization. And she talked at that conference that Jim had down in Georgia. And Jim had taken us over to Galloway Gardens, and there's a conservatory there that's full of all, the boy's name was Mike. And there's a conservatory there that has all these butterflies in them, thousands of butterflies. It's a wonderful place to walk in, and the butterflies are around you, and perfectly temperature controlled, and an incredible little Valhalla. And we're sitting there talking, and this butterfly came and landed on Shirley's stomach. And just gradually walked up her stomach and right out the end of her breath. And she looked at me and looked down at that butterfly, and she said, "Burns, that's Michael coming to tell me it's okay." And 8 years ago, where is God? And 8 years later, this is Michael coming to tell. It doesn't matter to me what you think about that event. What matters to me is that the miracle of recovery allowed this individual to see the same thing through a different pair of glasses. And I came to know that the miracle of recovery is not necessarily a change in what I see, it's a change in how I see it. You listened to Jim today? What you heard over and over in that talk, in that miracle talk, was not, I've been kicked, I've been beat, what is happening, our family is going down the tubes. Oh no, what he kept talking about was this opportunity, this window for this beautiful change. Instead of sitting there with the venom of, my wife has done this, oh my God, what has happened? No, it was a talk of hope. What he's seen hasn't changed. How he's seen it. Peggy M. from Nebraska. I listened to her talk about 2 years ago, and she was talking about when she first got sober. You remember when you first got sober, how you sat there and you can't be sure what's winter or summer? Only thing you can be sure is what kind of clothes you're wearing when you walk out the door. That tells you whether it's winter or summer, you know? Somebody dresses you and you walk out, if they put a coat on you, it's probably winter. You're going out in a short sleeve shirt. I'm telling you the truth. Maybe you didn't get that drunk. Maybe your recovery wasn't that bad. Hell, I used to lose my car drunk all the time. I lost it sober for a year. I lost my car in an 11-place parking lot next to my office. Now, I could practice medicine, but I couldn't cognitively think. You know? You know what it was like, and that's where Peggy was when she first got sober, and it was in the winter in Nebraska, and she would go out every morning and do something like what we can do, and that is go to the bathroom, make sure our pants are down, make sure they're up when we finish, and then go do something that might be constructive, like go to a meeting, call your sponsor, in this case, going out and feeding the animals. And she would go out there and put down the food, and the foxes would come up and eat the food, and she would go back in, and she'd come out the next day and put the food down. Her sponsor said, feed the animals, and that's what she did. In the spring, she went out, and she was feeding the animals, and she laid down the food and turned to walk in and felt something, turned around here. She said there was this fox sitting there about 5 feet away from her with its paws out in the front of it, its back leg pulled up underneath it, looking her right straight in the eye. And she said, I could look in that fox's eyes, and what that fox was saying was, thank you, Peggy, for saving my baby. And I'm sitting there listening to her say that, and I said, hell, man, I've hunted all my life, and I've seen I don't know how many wild animals in that stance, and what they're saying is, you make one move, sucker, and I'll bite your leg off, you know? I mean, that's what I see. And I realize that intellectually what I see is closer to the truth than what she sees. But what matters is what she saw for her. And the miracle of recovery is not a change in what she saw. To change in how she saw it. And I won't tell you about that miracle of recovery in my life. My talk is kind of weird the way I'm doing it today, but that figures knowing me, I'm the one I'm doing it because I do that. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, my birthday is December the 1st, 1977. And when I came in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, when I got home from treatment in, I guess it was March of 78. I came into AA in what I call the dark ages of Alcoholics Anonymous in Louisville, Kentucky. To be quite honest, it was in the dark ages of Alcoholics Anonymous in many parts of this country. Because it had turned predominantly into a program of personality and not principle. And certainly in Louisville, which I'm intimately familiar with at that point in time and today. The whole pitch was when you came in, don't drink, go to meetings, get a sponsor, tell him what's wrong with you, he'll tell you what to do, then you do what he tells you to do and then go save a drunk. And that was the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now I was willing to be told and I was willing to be led, so that's what I did. And for the first 9 years in AA, I read the big book one time. My first fourth step was in a treatment program which was a personal history. My second fourth step was a 300 question questionnaire from Hazleton, which wasn't where I was in treatment, but that was when I was 2 years sober. That's what my sponsor had me do. My third fourth step was a 250 questionnaire that my sponsor made up. Now, I mean to tell you, for 9 years in this program, I had a 3 1/3 step program. I had the first three steps wired. I knew damn well I was powerless over alcohol. It whipped my butt. Now, not only was I powerless because I couldn't quit drinking, I was powerless because I couldn't make it work. I could drink enough whiskey that I could stop the shaking and the diarrhea and the withdrawal, but I couldn't stop the noise. I couldn't stop the turmoil. I couldn't stop the feeling. All I could do was just stop shaking and quit puking and quit having diarrhea. So I knew I was powerless over alcohol. My life was unmanageable. You damn whistling, I knew my life was unmanageable. Because when I went into treatment, the first treatment program I was in for 3 weeks, my roommate hanged himself in the closet, and I'm sitting there looking at him hanging in the closet. And I thought, good God, you know, my life is unmanageable. And I really knew it'd take a power greater than me to restore me to sanity, and I was willing to follow directions. The third step was a bit hard for me, not because I wasn't willing to accept it and adopt it. I didn't understand it. And I'm a doctor who believes in cause and effect. I don't know whether I believe in it. I'm trained in it. And when I would look at that third step, which is an abstract concept, and let me tell you what we know about abstract concepts as alcoholics for 2 years, if we can't spell abstract. And yet I'm also dealing with this provincial thinking where I have to define the third step. I mean, I just intuitively have to define the third step. And I was going nuts. So what I did for almost 2 years, the first 2 or 3 years for the third step, was I remember when I was a little boy in the Baptist church in Mayfield, Kentucky, I'd rock in Sunday school kindergarten, 5 years old, and they'd say, God is love. So I would just rock and say, God is love. When I'd get under stress, I would just go somewhere and sit quietly and rock and say, God is love. And that made me feel good. So that was it. And that was fine. And if you're struggling with the third step, then let me tell you what your best bet is if you're struggling with the third step is go ahead and do a fourth one. You can sit there till the cows come home and you can flat run your head up your butt till your brains fall out and you'll never be able to define it in that first 3 years of sobriety trying to define the third step. And if somebody tells you to go back to the second step, you tell them, thank you, I'll go to the fourth. I've never seen anything happen going ass backwards. Most of it happens when you go face forward, okay? A little bit of preaching there, now I'll get back to my story, all right? Wait till I get to be 40 years sober. God, I may be lethal, right? In any event, I had the first three steps, and I had that third or the 12th step, because, I mean, I was all over Louisville, Kentucky. The story was, here he comes. You better drink a beer, because he's going to put you in treatment anyway. And, I mean, I was everywhere. I was a lethal weapon for God. I mean, I was just everywhere. Now, the fact of the matter was, in all of that, I noticed that all these people that I would get into treatment and drag off to places, they would come back and stick around with us for a while. The ones that had any sense kind of disappeared. They started going to their other meetings and all. And I didn't care. I thought, well, they just don't want to get the best. I wasn't talking about me. I was talking about an enclave of some of us. There were about 10 of us. And thank God the fellowship was indescribably beautiful because I hung on to about 5 or 6 guys in the program. And if they sit down on a commode, I sit down on the one next to them. If they went to play golf, I went to play golf. If they went to church, I went to church. I mean to tell you, we almost kissed each other goodnight every single night for 9 years. I mean, that was the way, and I've got to tell you, it was wonderful because I wanted to be a part of, and that's what this fellowship can be. You can be a part of. You'll find we played golf together. We did everything together. Then our wives would get involved in this thing. We did everything together. It was wonderful. And I still, these guys, I love them today. I love them today. But I got to tell you, at 9 years in this program, I was goofier than a goat. Absolutely goofier than a 3 and a 3rd step program just won't cut it. You know? And at 9 years in this program, driven by a series of events to my needs of my own self-centeredness, I was given Joe and Charlie's tapes of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll tell you how I got there. All alcoholics take hostages. Sometimes we call them pigeons. Sometimes we call them sponsorees. You show me somebody with 40 pigeons, and I'll show you somebody that's sicker than hell. And they just will. I just will. That's just what they are. I mean, they haven't got 40 sponsorees. They got 40 hostages. And it's notching their belt. I could be wrong, but rarely. In any event, we all take hostages. My biggest hostage was Casey. I mean, I'd had a real bad divorce for 17 years. Then I got drunk enough to make my wife mad enough to kick me out. Then I ran wild for about a year, and then ran into Casey. And you heard her story, those of you who are here, but we ran into each other. And our anniversary, not our wedding anniversary, but our anniversary of coming together was on Derby Eve. And this is Kentucky Derby in Louisville, and it's a big event. And on Friday night before Derby, we ran into each other, and we'd never been apart. Literally have never been apart. Well, we were for a little while. We went to Florida. You know, I know But I knew you would be the big dog was going to do, you know, go to Florida. Yeah. I mean, for a Kentucky boy, going to Florida is it, you know. I said, I'm going to make a move on this woman. You want to go to Florida? You know, hell, it don't get no better than that. You know, every time. Works every time, you know. But, and so she went, and as we were coming back after that week in Florida on the plane, I said, now, you got to realize that we just can't be together like this from now on. And she said, I understand. I said, you got to realize we're going to have to be apart some. She said, I realize we got to be apart some. So we landed. I took her to work and went home, got my clothes, picked her up, and moved in with her that night. We've never been apart since then. So that was our anniversary. Well, it was a wonderful relationship like she talked about. I mean, I bought her clothes. I never asked her what kind she wanted. I bought her cars. Never asked her what kind of car she wanted. I planned wonderful vacations. Never asked her if she wanted to go there. I took her to wonderful meetings. Never asked her if those were the meetings she wanted to go to. It was just, and I mean, everything was wonderful. I gave her everything I had. All I asked in return was everything back exactly the way I wanted it. And she did it. Wasn't a bad life. You know, I was a benevolent dictator. It was a pretty wonderful life. And then lo and behold, she comes up to me after 7 years of recovery and says, Burns, I've never loved you more, but I want to go back to college. I want to go into therapy, and I want to start attending my own meetings. And what did I hear?
You're leaving me.
You know, that's not what you said. That's what I heard. Now, let me tell you what my relationship with women is. You read the four steps as we go back through our lives, nothing counts but thoroughness and honesty. Right? Fifth chapter, four steps. So, in going back, so this isn't analytical, we go back and we look at those things. My mother, my grandfather died drinking lye water in the Mayfield City Jail. My mother was molested physically, emotionally, and sexually in that home. They had an interesting way of treating my grandfather in the middle 30s. When he'd get drunk, they'd put him in jail. When he'd sober up, they'd put him in chain gang sweeping the Mayfield City streets. And my mother used to walk past her daddy at least once a week in the chain gang sweeping the Mayfield City streets. The red letter was not adultery, it was alcoholism. My mother never really ever recovered from that. She wasn't an alcoholic. Today we call it an adult child syndrome. All you got to do is read the family afterward. It tells you, if you're around one of us, you get goofy. Now, Wilson called it neurotic. I just call it goofy. And mother was goofy. She was lovely and I think a mama every day. She died in 78. But my mother was goofy. She was goofy from the disease of alcoholism. Her whole ego and her whole alter ego came through me and my brother, her boy. I was the first Brady who ever went to college. And my daddy told me, he said it was, and I always wondered why I wanted to be a doctor. My daddy said, well, I'll tell you why you wanted to be a doctor, Burns Mack. He said, when I walked into the hospital room and the first day your mother was holding you, and she looked up at me and she said, Hal, she said, this one's going to be a doctor. Hell, I was primed to be a doctor. I'm sure my mother put me up, I'm going to be a doctor. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not bitching about it. But why do I want to be a doctor? I mean, that's just the way it was. Well, I found out that when I was perfect in this quest, when I was Jack Armstrong, the All-American boy, Mama was happy. When I wasn't Jack Armstrong, the All-American boy, Mama wouldn't talk to me. So I became Jack Armstrong, the All-American boy, and when I was the All-American boy, she busted my butt and parted my little hair and picked up my underwear, and she made me king baby. And what I began to realize that the deal was, without even thinking about it, I didn't realize it, was just intuitive, that a woman's role in my life was to take care of me and make me feel special. And that became my job description for all women. Without knowing it. Now you gotta realize that there are a lot of women that came in for one reason or another, maybe it's because I'm not particularly a dog and I can be gracious and all that other stuff. So I had a number of women came in my life. Most of them didn't stay very long, at least not the same ones. Hell, they got the hell out. The ones who stayed were just goofy as goats. I mean, they were really goofy. And they stayed around during that time, except for Casey. Now, she came in and she was very special. In fact, knowing that I had something special in my life was part of the equation of my wanting to get sober because I did not want to lose her. She was the first lady I'd had in my life who was very special. But it was this deal of take care of me and make me feel special. Now she's leaving me, so what do I automatically begin to do? What am I going to do? Find another woman. Right? I'm not even looking for one. It's just like the rocks in my head start looking for a woman who would fit the holes in hers, you know? And sure enough, I found one. I began this fantasy relationship with this woman in my office. I had one problem. I'd been around y'all for 9 years. And I realized what I was doing simply wasn't honest, and I'd really been drilled in the fact that you can't stay sober if you can't be honest. And this wasn't honest. I even fantasized that if I worked it just right, I was really sure, since I knew Casey was a wonderful woman, and this other woman that was all a fantasy relationship. But I knew she was a real neat lady, too, so I figured that maybe we all three could live together. I mean, why not? Why not? Now, Casey had never heard this because I never had the guts to tell it before, I guess. Probably had more sense than to tell it before then. You people have got me telling more than I ever really intended to say between my fly and this story. Hell, I better go home. I may not have a home, but never. But in any event, I mean, I reached that point, and I mean, I was really seesawed with this deal because I knew I loved this one, and I had a history with her, and I felt this thing that we feel, which is love. Let me tell you what, I found out one thing about feelings about that time. They're never to be ignored, but by God, they're never to be trusted. Because I can sit there and I can feel stupid. I can feel what the lump in my pants is. You know, I mean, I can feel. What do you feel? Well, hell, I'm not even in the same room, but I feel it, you know. That's why sponsors are wonderful. They help you know what is bullshit and what's not bullshit, you know. Because of what you feel. But I had these feelings, and I thought that was it. And I didn't know what to do, and I was screaming for help. And this little pigeon, I found this program, when the student's ready, the teacher will always arrive. Always arrive. And this little pigeon of mine came up and gave me these 8 tapes and said, listen to these and see if they're any good. And they were Joe and Charlie's tapes for the big book. And as I listened to those tapes, I just cried all the way through them because I knew the program I didn't have. I had 11 copies made, and 12 of us guys went into a big book study at that time, and my life began to change. Not only did we study the book, we did what it told us to do, and we really intensively began to pursue this program and design for living as outlined in our manual for living. And my life changed. And if anybody's been around for a while and they don't have a 12-step program and they're not following the directions that I will hopefully outline, it may help you, that certainly has been outlined for me and that I've tried to do today, then I'd suggest you consider whether or not you got a 3-step program or a 5-step program or what you got. I'm always fascinated by the number of meetings I go to where you're sitting in a room and somebody says, well, that's a 3rd-step problem. You got to turn it over. And I'm sitting there thinking, God, turn it over my ass. You know, what you got to do is, this is where you get started. I watch so many people stop at the 3rd-step and page 449 in the big book instead of realizing that's the place to start. That's the place to start. And even in the big book, the 3rd-step, it tells us this is only the beginning. And I watch so many people in meetings say, it's a 3rd-step problem. Almost every problem I've ever had is a 12-step problem. Not a 3rd-step problem. But in any event, my life changed. And as I became a student of this book, I noticed some interesting things. The first thing I found out is that my problem's not alcohol. And I'm going to tell you, if you're an alcoholic of my type, your problem's not alcohol. Now, I'm what's known as an addictionist. I've got qualifications, and I've taken exams that says I'm a specialist in the field of addiction. One of my students at the medical school told me the other day, well, after listening to you, your story, and listening to what you know, you ought to be a specialist in this field. You are your own lab rat. I said, you're right, you know. And she was right. But I can put on this whole wall up here, all the formulas that showed what Silkworth was saying when he said we have a physical allergy and mental obsession. Wilson and Silkworth would have loved to have been alive today, because all it does is validate exactly what they said at that time, only we got formulas and things to go with it. And we're learning every day more about this physical allergy and mental obsession. So if you're an alcoholic of my type, you're never going to be able to drink alcohol like a normal person. You're playing 2 sandwiches short of a picnic and being able to drink alcohol. Okay? But I need to tell you, if you haven't heard it before, your problem's not alcohol. And I can tell you for damn sure my problem's not alcohol. Now, alcohol caused me a lot of problems, and I can't drink it, but it's not my problem. And the book told me my problem was the 6 inches between my ears. It's called my mind. And he defined it classically as the peculiar mental twist. Now, if you think we think like normal people, then you haven't been out there in the real public very long, have you? I practiced family medicine for 25 years, and I saw thousands of people walk into my office, and they all reacted with fear when there should be fear. They all reacted with anger when it was appropriate. But they don't react at a red light like we do. You know, you're sitting at a red light, and somebody honks the horn, and your first impulse, I don't care what it is give them the sign, you know? And I mean, and the second one is to come out of there and kick ass, you know? Now, let me tell you what the first step in recovery is. You start to look in the rearview mirror before you get out of the car. That shows your judgment's getting intact. And then as you stay around the program longer, you begin to bring your finger in and start to say a prayer for whoever's behind you, you know? But we do that at a red light. I do that at a red light. And the way you're laughing, you do that at a red light, right? Not everybody does that at red lights. All drunks do it at red lights, but not everybody else. So, no, we don't think like normal people. Sit in the meeting, somebody says, well, so-and-so drank. Why did he drink? Because he's an alcoholic. And that's the dumbest damn thing you can ever say. Now, the fact is, it's true. But it's the dumbest thing you can say in a meeting. He drank a... Hell, I remember when I came in, I used to be afraid I was going to get struck drunk. I mean, I'm 42 years old at that time, and I'm a well-qualified physician, and I would sit at a red light thinking, oh, God, don't let me be struck drunk. Please don't let me be struck drunk. They'll never believe me. That guy last night drank because he's an alcoholic. I'm not going to drink, but hell, I'll be struck drunk, and they'll never believe a damn word I told him. That's just the way it is. And I'd go into a meeting, somebody said, I got a problem. I got a problem. I'm going to be struck drunk, and I'd do that. And you got somebody like me sitting there saying, well, so-and-so drank because he's an alcoholic. Well, when's my time? Oh, God, no. When's my time? Think about it. Maybe none of y'all were that tired. I mean, my rectum was about that big for the first 5 years in this program. Hell, man. I had to have Vaseline to go to the bathroom. And you said... And you're sitting there, and you're sitting there, and you sit in a meeting and hear that kind of stuff, and because I believe everything I heard. So when's my time? A peculiar mental twist. Yeah, he drank or she drank because they're alcoholic. But it's because of the way I think. The peculiar mental twist. And I want to talk to you about the peculiar mental twist. I want to tell you the kind of thinking that I do, that I have to deal with this program that we share on a daily basis. Because when people come in, I remember one of the first times I heard somebody come in and got drunk. And I turned to my first sponsor and I said, why did so-and-so, so-and-so got drunk Saturday night. And he said, I said, so-and-so had a slip Saturday night. He said, no, they didn't. They drank Saturday night. They had a slip about 6 months ago. Because that's when the thinking starts. You know, there's been people that have made a fortune, and frankly, I applaud them, talking about relapse dynamics. And you in the treatment program and some of the other people here will be taught relapse dynamics. The big book tells us it's all there. It's going to happen if we don't maintain the spiritual condition, right? So I want to share that. First, I want to start with a joke that's an alcoholic joke. Those of you who heard me talk have heard this. I've been telling it for 5 years, but I love it because it tells about an alcoholic. I was down in West Texas, or East Texas, talking. There's a fellow down there named Damon. Damon died about 90 years old and about 50 years sober. And he was the voice of a conference that I was speaking at, and Damon always talked like he had a flat brainwave. But if you got real close to him and listened, he was extremely humorous. And he was telling this story about this traveling salesman and what we used to call in Western Kentucky bad to drink. So this salesman would travel from town to town to town, and he would spend a week in this particular motel like the Ramada here, and when he'd check in, he'd get drunk. He'd work all day, go out that night and get drunk, come back in, and they'd do things to set him up to get his business. And he did this for years, and finally had all this fun he could tolerate, so he goes home, gets into AA, goes into the 28-day treatment program, intensive outpatient program. I don't know what he does, but he comes back sober. So he starts making this cycle again. He checks into the Ramada. Works all day. That night he comes in, has his dinner, goes out to a meeting, comes back, and they assume he's going out to get drunk like he always has. So he comes in and opens the door and flips on the light, and they got him set up to keep his business. And up next to the bed is a quart of whiskey and a tub of ice. And on the foot of the bed sit these two beautiful women. He said, well, I started going to AA, and I asked them what I needed to do to be happy and stay sober, and they told me I couldn't drink, and I had to change everything I'm doing. So I can't drink that whiskey. And one of you girls is going to have to leave. That's a real drunk, isn't it? I mean, that's exactly the way we think. That's it may be half measures, but it's the peculiar mental twist. First part of the peculiar mental twist for Burns Brady is being bigger than the rules. Listen to speakers talk about it. Listen to the person who's being bigger than the rule. Now, let me tell you. Silkworth said in his chapter that if these men, and he talks about men because they're essentially no women, if these men follow a few simple rules. I've watched people that I've tried to work with. I'm not going to practice any rules. I'm glad they say suggestions. When I came in here, I was begging you to have rules and that you would teach them to me and I could follow them. You know, I could follow those rules. I had a design for living that told me what to do. So yeah, we have rules, and my first part of my peculiar mental twist is being bigger than the rules. I've got 9 points on my driver's license. I have this tendency when I get in a 65 mile an hour speed zone to go 95 miles an hour. It just pisses off the police every single time. And they pull me over and they give me a ticket. And I was sitting home the other night and I was thinking, why'd I do that? I thought, well, I'm not stupid. I'm not crazy. The only reason I can figure it out is I do it because I'm Burns Brady. I thought, that's it. You do it because you're Burns Brady. Yeah. Bigger than the rule. Handicapped parking zones. I know you can't go in it, John. But I'm just going into the post office for 15 seconds. I can pull in there and go in the post office. Why? Because I'm Burns Brady. Yeah? Now, the psychiatrists call this narcissism. And my standing diagnosis for all those psychiatric admissions was psychopathological, narcissistic, sociopathic personality disorder. That's my psychiatric diagnosis, and the damn diagnosis is right, you know, because they diagnosed my behavior, and that's the way I behave. Even sober, it's the way I behave.